This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm Isaac DeVries, your host for today's episode. Today I'm speaking with Juliet Mitchell about her recent essay, Louise Bourgeois and Sigmund Freud, Passage Dangereux, The Girl in Psychoanalysis and Art. Her essay was published in 2021 by Yale University Press in a beautiful book to accompany the exhibition of Louise Bourgeois sculptures and installations here in New York City at the Jewish Museum. Both the exhibit and this book share the same name, which is Louise Bourgeois, Freud's daughter. My distinguished guest is Juliet Mitchell, who is a fellow of the British Academy, professor emeritus at the University of Cambridge, research professor emeritus at University College London, and emeritus fellow at Jesus College, Cambridge. Am I saying that? Is it Jesus College?
Yeah.
Is that right? After and alongside a career as a lecturer in English literature, she trained as a psychoanalyst and became a member of the British and International Psychoanalytical Societies. Before training, her introduction of psychoanalysis to emergent feminism culminated in Psychoanalysis in Feminism, which was published in 1974, which argued that Freud's work described the unconscious embedment of patriarchy in our sexuality. Juliet Mitchell, welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. On New Books in Psychoanalysis, we always start with the same question, and then our conversation unfolds over the remaining 50 minutes. And that first question is, to the extent that one can know their motivations, what motivated your writing this essay?
I had done quite a lot of reading, living in Louise Bourgeois' house in Manhattan. I read in the archives a lot of her work and just found that though a book by Mignon Nixon had talked about how psychoanalysis could help us understand Louise Bourgeois, and what Louise Bourgeois then contributed to psychoanalysis was indeed the aggression of women, I actually found that that was marvelous. I totally agreed with her, and it's terribly important. But I wanted to go further and look at sexuality along with aggression. So in other words, what would subsequently have been called in Freud's work, the life drive and the death drive, or in Louise's work, the use of male hysteria and female hysteria, and also her relationship with siblings, which I was working on very full time. So I've learned an enormous amount, not only from her writings, which have more and more been revealed, which Philip Larratt Smith is working with, but from her sculptures, by just looking at what she was doing with her art to help psychoanalysis look at something differently about a girl's Oedipus complex and a girl's sexuality.
Did you say that you were living in her home?
Staying, yes. There's a wonderful flat at the top of her house where you can stay if you're working on the archives, and they are very generous to you. And so, yes, I stayed in her. So it meant that I could walk around through her bedroom where she lived among her books, her kitchen, which was just not really a kitchen. It was a little galley where she wrote and painted on the walls wherever she was. Yes, marvelous experience to live there. But only, I didn't live there. I stayed there.
And this was after she had passed?
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
What was it like?
It's a brownstone in a very nice brownstone. Well, there's two now because they've got one which is which they open to the public, and one which is her private house, kept as her house. So it makes a big brownstone with a terrace off the back and straight onto the street at the front.
I heard that she had gutted the kitchen right afterwards, and that was somehow symbolic of her rage against the domestication of women.
Her kitchen, I think, there's nothing there. She just uses one ring to cook herself enough food, and it's really what she did in reversing her experience of being trapped as a housewife in those early paintings of a woman in an actual house with arms and legs coming out of the house. And she said afterwards, later, that she said she wanted to make the house look after her rather than her look after the house. And that's exactly what it does. The house is part of her work.
It's incredible. I've seen the pictures. I haven't been yet. It just seems like the space had become an expression of her internal world. And is that what you found?
An external world. I think the one was the other, in a sense, because she had those wonderful open houses for people to come and talk to her on a Sunday. And she just sat in a very modest way behind a small table, and people could mill around and talk and ask her questions and things. So I think her external and internal life wouldn't really have been separated in that sense. She lived her art, and her art lived her.
Yeah, I think I've seen, actually, there's some videos on YouTube that one can pull up and watch her interacting on these Sunday salons. I'm not sure if they were part of the Spider, the Mistress, and the Tangerine film, or if they were separate film footage. But in any event, there's some of them on YouTube. Have you seen those, by the way?
I tend more to go for people's recollection. So Mignon Nixon, for example, met with her and did her book totally in conversation, from conversations with her and from her own research, her own scholastic research as well. So I don't do much with YouTube and things. I just like to read books and see and talk to people.
So speaking of the texts and books, what's the story of these texts that were discovered? I think they were in 2003. Is that correct, when the first set of texts were found?
I can't remember the exact dates. Jerry Gorevoy, who's more than her assistant, her companion, her friend, and on whom she was totally dependent in an egalitarian way, but using him. Wonderfully. Can you still hear me? Because my screen's gone blank. Oh, good. That's fine. Yeah. No, my screen's gone blank, but that's okay.
I hear you wonderfully.
Good, good. Okay. Well, he came at 10 o'clock every day, 6 days a week, and that was so important to her. And he is a part of a lot of her works, like the very beautiful ones on Hysteria, the Arch of Hysteria in bronze, and the hands, which have got all the things of hands. They're his hands and her hands, and he's just terribly important. I've forgotten now what your question was at that point. Sorry, because my screen went blank and I went blank for a moment.
No problem. Well, I was asking about the texts.
They were sorting all the texts. So there was this whole wall of sorting that Maggie, the person who was doing it, a lot of the work had produced, and I read as much as they'd got. And then at a certain point, Jerry found a whole lot more loose page writing. And Philip, who we had hoped to be with us on this conversation, he is still working, producing books of her writing now, seeing her as a writer. I just used her writings. I haven't seen her as a writer. I learned from what she wrote about. She was one of the first people I've ever encountered who wrote about siblings, which is what I was writing about. I mean, in the field. I think perhaps I'm going to take a sort of cut there and say something slightly different, which I think is more important than what I'm beginning to talk about, though we can talk about it again later. I think the most important thing is that she had these decades of psychoanalysis until her analyst's death in 85, from 52 to 85, but certainly intensively from 52 till 66 about. But after that, after his death, I think by then she'd known so much. She read enormously in psychoanalysis. She wanted at one point to become a child analyst and thought about it very seriously, but didn't go that way. I think the art was by then becoming very successful and she was very embedded in it. But I think that I learned so much from what she understood and from what she was using for her art from psychoanalysis and giving to psychoanalysis from her art. And what we need to say about that first and foremost is it's a clinical knowledge. She worked so hard at her very, very lengthy, in fact, adult lifelong, in a sense, from the age of 40 till her death. I think she worked clinically, both with her analyst, but then later on her what we'd call a self-analysis, which you can only do if you're really deeply, deeply trained in psychoanalysis. You then can go on working in self-analysis yourself. And what she knew always was this big, massive change in herself, which is the only change that really can happen with psychoanalysis, which is instead of always bringing other people into the situation, your father, your mother who did this, or your siblings who did this, or whoever it is that did this, it's you that matter. It's what your contribution is. So you have to look at everything as what you contribute to the situation. And once she managed to get there with her analyst, which was terrifically hard work because she just didn't want to look at herself. She wanted to look at what her father did, what her mother did, what everybody else did, but she didn't want to look at what she did. And it's only when you can look at what you do yourself that then you can carry on and learn about possibly to do self-analysis if you've had a 30 years of analysis as she had. And it's absolutely her clinical embedment that I would emphasize.
So her, like when you were looking at the text, it's the clinical aspect of her writings that stick out to you?
Those are her writings in a sense. I mean, she read enormously, but the reading that she did, I mean, she read everybody. We all have to read, basically. I mean, her library is extraordinary. You should look at it. It's fascinating. And I know, and you can see she's marked things up and she's noted very embedded in the reading, but that fed into her clinical experience.
I'm wondering what Louise, the person, and through these writings, how did she speak to you as a woman and as an analyst?
I wish I'd met her. I very nearly did meet her. I was just about to meet her when she died, in fact. So that's a great disappointment and always will be a disappointment. But she formulated things that I was getting to in my own work, which, of course, as I'm a trained psychoanalyst, after writing Psychoanalysis and Feminism, I trained as an analyst and practiced psychoanalysis full-time for 25 years and then went back into academic work at Cambridge because I'd gone into it because I wanted to see where all the ideas came from, which indeed you do when you work clinically. And then after 25 years, I thought I needed to actually also look at it more academically as well, so I went in to teach it. And many other things happened in the meantime too. Most obviously my contribution to the rise of second wave feminism and my setting up a gender centre in Cambridge University, which is flourishing still. So a lot of what I was interested in, she was already interested in. So she was there before me. And so when I went to what she understood, it was fantastic. It was like confirmation from somebody who'd not only been there, had that thought, had thought it in her own way with her own context, which of course was an art context, which mine wasn't. I've done a fair bit of writing on art since, but at that time, I wasn't, and I'm still not an art historian or an artist. So she did it through her art. And I think that I mentioned this slightly in my essay, that really what's absolutely for me unique about that is that she uses, in a sense, a technique of psychoanalysis, which is the only requirement of psychoanalysis, is that we should free associate without let or hindrance, that we should say what comes into our head in order that we can get at what would otherwise be censored unconscious thoughts. And I think she used that for her art. So that, for example, if you're looking at one of her art objects, what she wants you to do is to free associate to it. So it's what you do in response to that art object. And so what I was doing in looking at her was, in a sense, just doing what she asked of us, which was free associating to it and thinking, okay, I had understood that about the female Oedipus complex, which is a major thing that she looked at, or having a brother, which is another major thing she looked at. And I found in her, or hysteria, which is another thing she looked at, I found ideas that I was getting into were already there in her, but through art, which I didn't know. And so I had to learn her art from scratch, from the beginning. I didn't know who she was when I was first asked to speak about her.
So, yeah, I had a question about this, because in your essay, you write quite personally and movingly about how to interact with her art through this associative practice. And when I was thinking about this, I was also reading Freud's essay, The Unconscious, at the same time. And it's there where he makes this startling assertion that unconscious speaks to unconscious, whether either party knows about it at all or not, right? And I consider myself in the tradition of modern analysis, coming out of Hyman Spotnitz and Phyllis Meadow. And there's a heavy emphasis there on induction, on psychic induction in the transference and countertransference, where unconscious speaks to unconscious. And I was really curious about this process that you discovered with Louise Bourgeois. And you seem to suggest that this is the way that she wanted us to, or she encouraged people to engage with her art, the way to understand her art. And it sounds like it's the way that you came to experience and understand her art. I was wondering if you could take us a little bit further into that and describe what the process is like. Is it different than what one does in analysis? Is it the same?
Well, in a sense, you've hit on the question that I was asking myself in that essay. I think when I'm writing something, something always new comes up to me, and that was the new thing that came up to me for that essay. Because what I was really asking was, is she asking us to free associate to her art? So she's not asking us to tell us what she means. She's wanting to see if we can free associate to what she has produced. They're her associations, which should elicit our associations. And my question was, is that the same that if we then look at the art invites us, the art itself invites us to free associate. Is that a possibility? And that was really a question to myself, and which I've asked in that essay. And I tried, yes, a personal instance. I tried it with the couples because I knew something about where they were in the church.
If for our listeners, it was couple one that you...
Yes. Well, right. there were more than... There was couple one that was on display, first of all, where I live in Cambridge in England. There's a lovely place called Kettle's Yard, which I adore as an art house, an art exhibition space, but it was a cottage where you could always go and sit and just look at all the art and all the art books and things. It's been a beautiful place to be. And they had an exhibition in which of her work, and that was there, and I was looking at it there. And then I saw it again up in Edinburgh in Scotland, in both cases with two different friends. And I was actually hearing their observations of what we were looking at. They're two very different friends. And then thinking, well, I'll try it for myself. Because the church where it was hung originally was one just beside where I actually nursed on Friday nights, Saturday nights, and Sunday nights, when being in being a graduate in English literature, I had to get clinical experience before they would accept me for training as a psychoanalyst. And I would write off to them saying, well, if I did this, and I'd cite something like, you know, could I be a student counselor? And they'd write back saying, we'll ask at our next meeting in 3 months' time. And then I woke up one morning and thought, oh, wait a minute, they're asking me to do something I've never done before. And I thought, well, what have I never done before? And I thought, well, even as a little girl, I never wanted to be a nurse. So I wrote back and said, if I became a nurse, would that count as clinical experience? And they didn't wait for any meetings. They just wrote back and said, yes. So then I got just an ordinary nursing job wearing black tights and black lace-up shoes and a little white cap and a black belt and a white coat and was just an ordinary nurse. But I could only afford that because I had to pay for my analysis as a trainee analysis. I had to pay for that at the same time. So I could only afford to do that nights on weekends. And the church was next door. And I was in... I can't remember what they call it now, but a psychiatric ward in this ordinary public health hospital. And I could sometimes take some of the patients out for walks. And one of the places we used to walk was this church and graveyard next door to the hospital. And that's where her sculpture had been.
So it was through the associative process to the sculpture that
I used that to test myself. Uh-huh. I think, is she asking us to free associate ourselves to the sculpture, to join her free association to it in producing it, which is part of her artwork, and therefore can art do something comparable to something clinical? And that was my question to myself. And so I did it as a test on myself to see if I could free associate to it, because I had lots of associations to it, many more than I put into the book. I think incidentally it's why you get so much humor in her work, because you know, once you start really free associating, something very funny comes up. You just start laughing or crying. You know, all sorts of emotions come up. It's about emotions, I think, in the response. And of course, I don't know in your training, but in my not just my training, in my practice, I find that the fact that if we make interpretations and these aren't felt emotionally, they're completely have no impact at all. It's only when we emotionally experience what has been told to us in language, it's only then that they have meaning for us. And of course, emotions are not the same as the unconscious of language. So I think that she's contributing something. This is something now that I'm working on. I'm thinking it's not in the essay, but I think she was also working very much in working and being so interested in herself as a girl. She was also working in with herself as just having these associations to her own work.
I want to move us along because of time, but I'm wondering
Can I ask you what time we stop, so as I know when we're coming to an end?
Yeah. Traditionally, I think we're at 11:40, so I think we've got about 30 more minutes. But I'm hoping we go a little Winnicott and go overtime if you don't have some place to go.
I do, unfortunately, have some place to go. I mean, we can do it again at some point if you'd like it at some point.
I'd love that. One of the exhibits in that was up here at the Jewish Museum, and also a central piece of your essay has to do with her installation or her sculpture, The Dangerous Passage.
Yes.
And you seem to suggest that there's something going on here that not only challenges but transforms psychoanalysis. I'm wondering if you could talk more about how you see her challenging and transforming psychoanalysis. What do you have in mind?
Oh, lots of things in which she's really saying something quite new. For example, if one works in the field of hysteria, one can't help being struck by how male hysteria keeps appearing, from all through history, it's appeared and always disappears. And it was Louise who put her finger on it for me. I noticed it and been interested and thought about it, but why is it keeps disappearing? And basically she says, well, for men, it's what we would call, well, for women, it's ego dystonic. We can't make what the hysterical woman wants is it to be all about herself and herself to always get what she wants, which is then never quite what she does want. But for men, it's not ego dystonic, it's ego syntonic. In other words, men are always talking just about themselves. All men want is about themselves all the time. And if they don't get what they want, even if it turns out to be not what they want, but if they don't get what they want all the time, then they make a hysterical scene. And so it's dystonic for women and syntonic for men. And to me, that was a brilliant way of, and a quite funny and humorous way of perceiving it, that, you know, that her husband, when he was still alive in her marriage, if he or her sons didn't get full attention, then there was a scene about it. If she didn't made a scene about getting full attention, which she did, then everybody saw her as disturbed and hysterical.
Right.
So it was a personal experience of hers that she just eventually was able to put very humorously. I could give you other instances. Now they're not coming to me, but they'll come to me in a moment. But that was a very... there are many places. Oh, yes, when I first got interested in siblings, and actually that was before I read or before I watched and read and looked at her. So I had already written about it, as I had about hysteria. But she summed it up so well. In terms of what turned out to be a tragic situation of her own younger brother, and her own terror that he became effectively schizophrenic, and she was terrified that she would be, as she saw it, sort of crazy too, and she had lots of dreams and lots of feeling about it, and the important but what she said that was sort of new for psychoanalysis, and what I've since read, just written another book, just finished now, another book on, is that psychoanalysis doesn't look at sibling relations, it only looks at parental-child relationships. And, you know, I've just finished a book which my psychoanalysis and feminism was about patriarchy. The book I've just finished is about fratriarchy. It's about siblings.
Did you want to say more?
Well, it's the dominance of men again within the fratriarchy, of course, but that's not what the whole book's about. The whole book is looking at what I call the horizontal axis of psychosocial relations, which lead on to marriage, friendship, war, enemies, etc. And that's where, for example, we really find violence against women. I was talking about violence against women just two nights ago on Zooming Peru. Well, I was supposed to be in Peru. I was supposed to be in Lima. And to my great disappointment, I had to Zoom it. But talking about that, and she had got there to the importance of lateral relations on a horizontal axis. She'd got there. And so I was able to use her work again. So, you know, so much she got somewhere. She just got there she worked so hard. She said, as I say in my essay, why don't people see that my tenacity is a good thing? Tenaciousness is good. And that's identical to what Freud said about himself, that he was a conquistador whose main characteristic was the tenacity with which he worked at something. And, you know, they both of them were capable of changing their minds, because that's what you do. If you look at something, it seems something at the beginning, and then it begins to look like something different, and then it looks like something else again, then you go back to what it was at the beginning, and you just keep on, you don't stop. And she shared that characteristic with Freud, that they were both extremely tenacious.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, I picked up on that in your essay, and I picked up on from her writings and also the video footage that I've seen of her, and certainly the way that she went about her analysis as well. Tenacity for her was an expression of her aggression, which unlocked her sexuality, it unlocked her art, it unlocked and made possible her analysis. I mean, she does come across as one of the most tenacious people, although I didn't meet her, that I've encountered. And I think some of this tenacity comes out in the actual installation and sculpture, The Dangerous Passage. And I was wondering if you would be willing to talk about what she does there with the Oedipus complex. You seem to suggest in your essay that she really gives us the girl, the sexual girl, in a way that other authors, other clinicians, other theorists, Freud himself, they didn't get. And I see this, you know, in your essay, it seems to be one of Louise Bourgeois's crowning like achievements, her contributions to psychoanalysis, but also one of the moments in which she changes and transforms it. Would you speak on what she does with the Oedipal complex?
Yes, you see, again, it's something that, having been interested and written about it and thought about it, I again found in her, if you see what I mean. It was terrific. And it is what I think made for what other people would call a cure. People didn't think she was cured because she smashed, she destroyed her work quite often, smashed things on the ground and had temper tantrums. And you asked me about that actually in an email to me at one point. And first of all, I'd recommend anybody to Mignon Nixon's book on the importance of female aggression. And I would say that, as I was just mentioning this talk I gave about violence against women a couple of nights ago, I actually said that I think that the fact that women have to not be aggressive is as much part of the oppression against women as the fact that there's huge violence against them. Of course, the violence against them kills them, and so it's more serious, whereas not being aggressive doesn't kill anybody. And when you were saying that, I think you said that everybody always thinks she's just appallingly aggressive. In fact, one of the most scary things I did, I stood up at a huge celebration in New York, and the most wonderful dinner overlook onto the Hudson, and her eldest son had spoken about how difficult it was she was as a mother and how aggressive she was, and I got up and spoke about her aggression and that it was perfectly legitimate, and I was so nervous doing that, nobody spoke to me afterwards. So, well, one person did afterwards, that's not true, but anyway, aggression is incredibly important for women, because without being able to be destructive, how could you ever be an artist? So if people say, why aren't women great artists? Well, A, they are great artists, but B, they also might be very inhibited from being great artists, because as women, we're not supposed to be aggressive. And of course you have to be aggressive, because you have to destroy while you create. It's part of creation is to destroy. And I just ask you one question, in a sense. You say that she makes other people like Pollock, etc. No, it wasn't Pollock. Who was the aggression you spent? Anyway, some of the people you thought were very...
Oh,
Pollock.
Yeah, I said remember? Her... Freud,
wasn't it? One of them was Lucian Freud, who made me cry in public, which is I've only done twice in my life. He was so... I found him so vicious. She's not vicious. She smashed objects. You cannot imagine Louise smashing a person. She might have, she just desperately needed Jerry Gorovoy, and thank goodness for both, or for her certainly, that he was so wonderfully there for her. But you can't imagine her just attacking him physically or anything like that. Mm-hmm. However desperate she got, she threw things on this. She threw her work on the floor. She broke her work in order to remake it. That's a different sort of aggression. That's the sort of aggression that I think we need as women to bring into the world, that sort of aggression that's creative. And I think aggression was creative.
Right. I mentioned, I had read Mignon's, her essay on rage and aggression. in Philip's book, Return of the Repressed, which also has your essay, I think, or at least an essay that you have on her sublime jealousy, which is where I think some of this work on siblings was in the background.
Definitely, yes.
Anyway, I love the essay by Bimignon, and what I had said to you was something that I actually got from my supervisor and our editor-in-chief here at New Books in Psychoanalysis, which was that, you know, nobody wants to touch her rage, her aggression. And she described it as volcanic rage and aggression. That's how she described her unconscious. And I said, you know, it doesn't seem like it's been adequately attended to in the literature. And I asked, or I said, I think she makes Francis Bacon seem like Calder, which actually is a comment that I had gotten from Tracy. But yeah, I had a number of patients who went and saw the exhibit. And one of them came back, and he's this guy who, all he wants is like a Kantian sublime experience. He wants to be able to sit in front of of a piece of art and just kind of take it in and have this glowing, you know, oceanic experience. And he came back to session after seeing the exhibit over the weekend, which had the destruction of the father and the dangerous passage, as well as a number of her other sculptures on display. And he hated it. He could not sit there. He could not take it in. He could not, he couldn't be with her work. It made him physically uncomfortable. And it had to do with her aggression. It had to do with her rage. And I wondered if you wanted to say anything more about the role, the necessity of aggression, the necessity of rage, not only in analysis for everyone, but also for women. I know that you were just speaking about it a bit, but I wondered if you wanted to say more about the importance of aggression, what role it has to play, what role you see it playing now in people's individual lives, but also more broadly for the women's movement.
Oh, I think Greta Thunberg is my heroine in this at the moment, because I'm very involved in one small personal way, in the horror of the climate situation. And I think when she was at the co-op meetings that we've just had in Glasgow, she's very, very brilliant. Autistic she may be, but she's extraordinarily clever, really, really clever, interesting, intelligent woman, young woman, very young woman. And she was asked about this, and she said, look, I'm afraid we're right to be angry. We've got to be angry. We mustn't hurt anybody, but we've got to be angry. This is something to be angry about. And the fact that people are just going blah, 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 talking there, and half the time, actually, they're not telling the truth and all the rest of it. Not that she said that, but I think that, that when there are things that one should be angry about, one should be angry. It's as simple as that. And your it's a patient, you said, I think it was. Is it a patient who hated it so much?
Yes.
When I was first asked to speak at occasion on Louise Bourgeois, it was at the Tate Modern, and it was this huge retrospective of her. And there was a small day conference beforehand, and the exhibition wasn't open, so I hadn't been able to see it. I didn't know who on earth she was or what she'd done really at all. Her gallery in London, House and Worth, was closed. I managed to see something in what was left of the British library when it was still a proper museum and had one room. And there were four pieces, I think it was four, possibly five pieces by Louise with Francis Bacon in the Tate Modern. And the first one I looked at was Amoeba. I don't know if you can see it, but perhaps you can show people. I don't know. But anyway, look at Amoeba, it's everywhere. I hated it, absolutely hated it. I went on and I liked Villette, and I was quite interested by the two other ones. I won't go into them now, but anyway, I hated Amoeba, and I thought, what do I do? Because I just hate this. So I thought about what you do when you hate something. And I spoke about I had only about 20 minutes in this conference to speak. I talked about what you do when you hate something. And the talk went viral. And so that's why I got asked to do more things on Louise Bourgeois. So I think when you hate something, it's your own hatred you have to think about. Why do you hate this so much? What is it in it that makes you hate it? What is it in you that's free associating to it, that is touching something in you that hates it? There's nothing wrong with hating it. Why shouldn't you hate it? We all hate some art, and we all hate, like and love and hate different bits of art. We don't all like the same thing all the time. It doesn't matter whether you love or hate it. What matters is you think about it and respond to it, that you have an emotional response which you can think with.
Against this backdrop, I've been thinking a lot about hate recently. I'm in training at the moment, and in some classes we're reading a lot of Freud, and we're talking a lot about the drives and love and hate. And it's been interesting to be working with this installation and exhibit on the destruction of the father, which was also in the exhibit and also talked about in your essay pretty explicitly. It's a pretty liberating thing to be able to hate one's loved objects as well. And I was wondering if you would like to speak a little bit about the destruction of the father, the installation, the piece of art, what it has to do with psychoanalysis, what it's meant for you.
Well, I think it's about her relationship with her mother as much as with her father, because I think it's through that she gets into a touch with a very positive relationship with her mother, which she writes about a lot too, as well as puts into her art, of course, into Maman and all the other amazing ones about her mother's clothes and her mother's tapestries and what her mother does, etc., and with her siblings too, because though it's and it also, I think, subsequently, it enables her to change her relationship with her father, because they gobble him up, basically, and laugh about it. And that's there, as well as, in destroying him, there's a good side to destruction too, which is that, as I say in the essay, we say to children, I'm going to gobble you up. And they think it's very funny and lovely, because after all, they've gobbled up their mother. They've gobbled up her milk and everything. And so gobbling is a sort of, is a love-hate relationship. Not one or the other, it's both. And I think that Louise is very good at both emotions, and that's because she's so in touch, as she herself would claim, so much in touch with the unconscious. And of course, we don't have contradictions in the unconscious. We have things that are identical, they're the same. So love and hate come together. They can happen simultaneously. And I think that's what is going on for me. There are other things going on too, and it's been brilliantly written about. But we all take what we associate to it, and for me, it's both. It's the beauty of it. It's because it's rather beautiful as well. I mean, aesthetically beautiful. That comes from that combination of being funny and laughing and loving at the same time as destroying the father. Then we didn't talk about what I was going to talk about when you asked one question way back. I went on to something else, which was her contribution in Passage Dangereuse. I think it's her exposure of the female Oedipal complex it's terribly important too. Again, it's something I had thought about differently and found her work just marvelous in relation to what I had been interested by, which was that what the female Oedipus complex, well, first of all, everybody has a male one, in relation to incest with the mother, and so every girl has a male Oedipus complex. But then, on top of that, she's supposed to have this female Oedipus complex, and Louise is just both funny and both radically revolutionarily disposing of it, because she looks at it in relation to what effectively is prescribed by the girl's Oedipus complex, and which I think Passage Dangereuse is also about. That's about things in much more detail, as Philip has shown very brilliantly. Not in this book, elsewhere. But it's, as a general theme, it's about what the girl has to do effectively to get her father to seduce her. That the girl, being, as Freud would put it, already castrated, enters her particular Oedipus complex by a girl's one, which is to want the father to want her. So away, lo and behold, the father does seem to want her, or if he doesn't, then he's always playing as Louise's father, so very much did so as a philanderer. He was, like so many men, a philanderer. And so he was always going, or always in her mind, preferring somebody else to herself. So she felt always abandoned by him, and that nobody could ever love her enough. That was the most personal part of her world, is that she could never get anybody to really love her, because basically the father is always both incestuously wanting her, but also wanting somebody else more because of the philandering nature of masculine sexuality.
And yeah,
go on.
Oh, I was. Are you sure you're done? I was
going to. We'll get there. We'll get where we want to get.
Yeah, I was talking about this moment in your essay with Tracy Morgan, and the way that she suggested I read this essay by Diane Elise. I don't know if you're familiar with this. It was published in Gender and Sexuality in 2000, but it's this essay called Women and Desire, Why Women May Not Want to Want. Are you familiar with this essay?
It's ringing bells, but I don't say I'm familiar with it.
Okay, so... So I was thinking about this dangerous passage passage dangereux, and your comments on Louis Bourgeois and this area, and this idea that the Oedipal is different for the woman because she has to, in addition to rejecting the mother or the love object, she has to seduce it, right, as well. And Diane Elise observes that actually the first loss and rejection for boys, girls, and otherwise actually happens with the mother. And it happens at the breast, not with the father. Like, the infant's erotic sensuality and desire is first with the mother. And whether it's because of the mother's own homoerotic conflicts, her guilt over incestuous desires, her social conditioning, or what have you, mothers often can't recognize and appreciate the girl's sexual desire for the mother. And Elise goes on to say that this is universal, and that what every woman and person originally wants and is forbidden is their mother. And Freud says this too, right? He says, whereas the boy's desire for the mother is acknowledged and then forbidden, the girl's desire for her mother is never acknowledged and celebrated. It's only erased and negated and repressed. And so feminine sexual desire remains unrecognized, and neither the girl or the mother are seen as sexual or sensual objects. And we know that this is, like, often the case, that girls are not gazed at or caressed by the mother as boys are. And on average, boys are breastfed much longer than girls are. So there's this rejection of the girl in her sexuality and her excitement. And Freud says that when she then turns to the father, she stops masturbating. Her sexuality is permanently injured. Her erotic sexuality, previously in motions, brought to a halt. And so women go on looking to find their mother and their husbands. So this whole, like, heteronormative injunction gets internalized and brings the women's desire to a close. So I'm wondering, against this backdrop, if the Oedipal that Freud talks about is actually a kind of repetition, a kind of castration 2.0 that has to be, like, endured and suffered. And yet all of the scholarship around Louise Bourgeois points to her Oedipal dynamics with her father. And you write, for example, that the psychic untenability of the girl's Oedipal destiny, you go on to write that what psychoanalysis considers inevitable is in fact the impossible condition of a woman's sexuality under patriarchy. I wondered if you would expand on that.
Much of it that you were describing of that particular essay, Louise does address. She talks about the mother as the first person who abandons her, and that's the first abandonment. She talks about how they become women together by wanting to steal, not wanting to to take, but just both be wanting to steal because the father is always somewhere else, etc., etc. A lot of that is in Louise's work. A lot of it's around. I'm not disagreeing with it, but it's not what to me is important. What to me is important is that psychosexual aspect of society, that's that thing that divides our unconscious from our conscious, our preconscious, is the prohibition that you're not allowed. Those forms of excess sexuality, which go under a collective name of incest, you're not allowed those forms of killing that goes under the name of murder. You can fight in a war, you can have all sorts of, you can, as I say, be a philanderer, etc., etc. But it's the prohibition, it's not the desire, it's the prohibition on the desire which creates society. And so what you've got is a situation which differs between men and women, in which the male, and that goes for the girl, the part of the girl that has the same male psycho and same as the boy's male sexual case, goes under the prohibition of no incest, no murder. But the girl's prohibition, if you're looking Oedipally, isn't there. You're not prohibited sex or not prohibited murder with the father or mother. The prohibition is missing. So my work is on, actually, there's an earlier prohibition, which I call the law of the mother. And that's what enables the girl, as a sister, not as a mother, but as a sister, to have a prohibition which makes her part of society. So I'm interested in a different aspect of it, which is missing, I think, in that essay. And therefore, if you don't put it in, there's some things that are, I mean, they may be universal experiences, but they're not universal requirements or laws. Those are prohibitions against incest. And again, they're the only things that produce, well, with the Oedipus complex, they produce repression. With my law of the mother and the sibling lateral relations, its earlier defences, its denial, its depersonalised, it's all sorts of other resistances, earlier ones than repression. And there's primary repression, not secondary repression, as with the Oedipus complex. So let's call it just primary repression for the moment.
Got it. Well, I'm conscious of time now.
Yeah, I am too. And I think it's probably quite a good place. I feel I've said something I'm pleased to have said, because I think it's very important. And I think it's what gets missed out. And thank you very much. It's been very interesting to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for being here as a guest on New Books in Psychoanalysis. I am Isaac DeVries, and until next time, this is our show for today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Isaac. And thank you very much for the Almodovar reference, which I haven't looked up yet. It sounds wonderful.
You're welcome. Okay, we'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah, take care. Bye.